Hello and welcome to the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, there are some 36 situations that could be considered pre-genocidal, according to scholars of genocide. We'll explore the lessons we've learned from past genocides. Then on the Scholars Circle, we'll attempt to untangle the enormous changes and tumult in the Middle East. Scholars of genocide have identified nearly 36 situations around the world that could be considered pre-genocidal. These are states that could attempt to annihilate their ethnic and religious minorities. What have we learned from past genocides, such as the one that occurred in Rwanda in April of 1994? We're joined by General Romeo Dallaire. He was commander of the peacekeeping forces in Rwanda and had tried to stop the mass killing of the Tutsi people there. He is also the co-director of the Will to Intervene Project and the author of two books, Shake Hands with the Devil and They Fight Like Soldiers, They Die Like Children. General Dallaire, I wonder if we could start with your return to Rwanda. I recently revisited a talk you gave on the internet where you addressed the Rwandan people and where you apologized for your failures.
In my tour, the 10th anniversary, I said that I would like to stop and speak at a class at University of Butare, the National University. We're doing the trip around the country. When we arrived there, they had to move it to the outside stadium, football stadium. And there was about 7,000 people there. And so I spoke. And one of the things I emphasized, not only the fact that I, as the commander of the mission, failed and my mission failed to protect them and to establish an atmosphere of security, I said the era of the white man coming back to Africa to reestablish security and so on is over. I said the sub-Saharan black African is simply not going to attract the engagement of the developed world, the North, unless there is a self-interest in there, and a country like Rwanda doesn't have that. And I said, you will have to take on, through your organizations like the African Union, the ability to self-protect. As I was saying, the white man is not coming back. The clouds had started to form because it was a rainy season. So in the rainy season, it's lovely sunny, and all of a sudden, boom, clouds appear. And then the next thing you know, downpour. And as I'm saying this, the sky got black. And I had just finished saying it. And this incredible thunder clap just happened. And it reverberated over the corrugated scale roofs of the stadium. And it was an incredible reaction. And it just made such an impact that afterwards so many of them came back and said, even the skies recognized that we were into a new era. Mm. And so I thought that was quite revealing.
One of the things you said there, or what was captured on the video that I did see, was you were talking about how the Western world and the United Nations responded to Yugoslavia, but not to Rwanda.
Yeah. The video you mentioned, which is also called Shake Hands with the Devil, of my trip back at the 10th anniversary with my wife and rewalking the terrain of the genocide. One of the horrific quandaries in which you find yourself in the field is that you have to operate with what you're given, but you're also conscious of what's going on elsewhere. And as I was fighting to get even a budget, let alone the troops I needed, even getting them food, and then the genocide explodes, and the next thing I know, countries are pulling their troops out, and I'm getting the orders, in fact, to withdraw, which I'm refusing. At the same time, Dayton had happened, and we deployed 67,000 troops in ex-Yugoslavia. And the question is, how come I couldn't keep 450 soldiers to provide protection to a small portion of that population, and there were more people killed, injured, internally displaced, refugeed, and raped in 100 days in Rwanda than there was in the 6 years of the Yugoslavian campaign? And so what are the criteria that our political elites use? I think the most pejorative side of that is our populations and citizens let them get away with to decide that they're going to invest massively in a European country that's internally hemorrhaging, but that sub-Saharan black Africans simply don't count. Not only that, but Yugoslavia has no real significant natural resource. It's just situated in Europe. You sort of say, well, you know, it's there as part of maybe the European security context. In Rwanda, there was nothing there either. But the people didn't at all feel ashamed of saying that, you know, there's nothing in Rwanda. There's no oil, no strategic resource. There's nothing of any value. Anything that's there are human beings, and there's too many of them anyway. And so they used that argument.
Did you actually hear that argument?
No. I was briefed. Nations and powerful nations came in within the first week to do assessments. They sent in a small reconnaissance team to look at the situation and then to be able to go back to their national capitals and then decide whether or not they're going to give the UN any resources. That's where the exercise changed in regards to who really is ultimately responsible. Up until the time that these nation states actually came on the ground and looked at the situation, the UN was running the show, and the UN was providing the information to the Security Council, and they were feeding all the nations and all the national capitals and so on. But when these countries came to Rwanda, looked at it and decided they weren't not going to come in, then that meant that they had decided that they would not provide the UN with the resources it needed to stop the genocide. Then that responsibility of the genocide fell on those nation states. And so ultimately, the culprit, or the ones that are really have blood on their hands, are not necessarily the Secretariat of the UN, nor in the field, although we made mistakes, and of course we have a sense of responsibility, as I do as the mission force commander. But those who deliberately took decisions not to provide the UN with any assets to influence the situation, they're the ones that are to be held accountable for the continuum of the slaughter and ultimately the genocide. And that's every nation state in the world. That's why the subtitle of my book, Shake Hands with the Devil, is The Failure of Humanity in Rwanda. They completely lost their sense of humanity amongst themselves with the slaughter. But the rest of humanity abandoned the Rwandans.
So you named several failures that we have to learn from. The failure in humanity in Rwanda, the failure of humanity in the international community, perhaps it's even a bigger failure in that it's what shapes our considerations. And then it sounds like the institutional failures as well.
It would be just too easy to use the only international body that exists that has the ability to bring nations together and regions of the world together on a variety of subjects. I mean, the UN was founded by those five permanent members essentially to prevent them from going to war with each other. And all the rest of the stuff that's come on since, you know, UNESCO and everything else, UNICEF, have been additions in the maturing of that ability. And peacekeeping only started in 1956 with the concept where belligerents decide that they don't want to fight anymore and they need a sort of a referee to make sure that people play by the rules as they reestablish them. The concept was based on the fact that nation states would be going after other nation states. And then when the Cold War ended, it found itself all of a sudden facing a whole series of imploding nations and failing states that previously had been held under wraps by the big powers, in fact, mostly the permanent five, who had put a lot of dictators in power and, you know, kept control on these artificial countries that came out of the colonial era. So bingo, they find themselves all of a sudden having to face these catastrophic failures with very, very demanding timelines. There's revolutions, there's assassinations, there's breakdown in social structures, and worse than that, there's massive abuse of human rights. There's a fundamental sort of visceral desire to sort these problems out by actually going at the other ethnicities, tribalism, and religious reasons. So much of that explodes. I mean, it didn't sort of come on slowly. It exploded. And it was the Cambodia, it was Somalia due to famine. You had the Congo that was starting up. And in Central Africa, you had also Burundi that had a coup d'etat. And then Rwanda, which was in a civil war. And on the West Africa, well, you had Sierra Leone that was teetering on war. You had Liberia. I mean, this place was just festering of peoples wanting to sort out what their nation state should be, because they were created in artificial boundaries with no logic at all in their sort of ethnic groups or whatever. The UN all of a sudden faces this, and the international community says, oh, by the by, Cold War is over, peace dividend, we don't need big militaries anymore. We don't have to spend on expensive security systems. Life is going to be in a new world order. George Bush Sr. Yeah. said that. And on the contrary, it may have sounded secure up in the northern part in the Europe sort of developed world, at least for a while, until Yugoslavia exploded. The rest of the world was going to hell in a handbasket. And the UN was the only body left to pick up the pieces, didn't have the tools, didn't have the people, didn't have the structure. Peacekeeping was a very small little select group of about 13 developed countries that would go in, you know, when nation states were at each other. All of a sudden, what you needed was fighting troops. You needed people who could defend others. And it exploded into something of in the order, by the time I got there in 93, of about 50,000 troops around the world with no equipment, no logistics, and mandates that people were pulling out of the air to try to figure out. I mean, my mandate was establish an atmosphere of security. So you sort of say, okay, I've been 30 years in NATO, and my mandates have been to attack, defend, withdraw, bypass. You know, I've even handled nuclear weapons. All of a sudden, I'm in a developing country in the middle of nowhere, and I'm told to establish an atmosphere of security. And the question is, what does establish mean? Do I defend the country when I'm demobilizing both armies against a third party? How far do I use my troops in using force to establish? And what is an atmosphere of security? Right. A police state? No weapons? And so mandates started to come out. No resources came to the UN because at that time, the big powers, in particular the United States, had said, that's it, we're not paying anymore because a lot of this money is wasted. So massive deficits were there. We couldn't get budgets to deploy troops. And the real kicker in this comes from the fact that the developed countries start to do a Pontius Pilate trick on the UN. And what they do is they say, okay, these are all brush wars and these are problems there and so on. There's really nothing in it for us that much. And on top of that, you got Somalia and you got Black Hawk Down and Bill Clinton gets cold feet and pulls out, or accelerates anyways the pull out. So the world power is not keen on playing in this. And so the UN has to go to developing countries to pick up the slack. And they've got no skills, they've got no equipment, they've got no logistics. And yet the same permanent five are still creating mandates to go into Cambodia and go into Mozambique and in Rwanda. But we don't want you to spend money. We want you to minimum force, minimum capabilities, and get out of there as fast as you can. Well, that abdication by the developed world, the white world in particular, to letting the UN carry the can, established the whole strategic scenario in which ultimately, extremists could thrive because they argued that nobody's really going to come. And that's what these guys did in Rwanda. They made their plan. They developed the genocide plan. I mean, they sat around. They developed a plan right down to every 10 huts in the country. They had lists of every Tutsi, where they were. They had lists of every intermarried couple that existed. And the militia was created out of their youth movement that they trained and armed and equipped, and it was all evolving. We were passing all that information up, and there was nothing coming back because nobody wanted to play in it. Why? Because they were all busy with sort of Cambodia, maybe closing down a bit. We were busy with Haiti that was cranking up, that's close to home, and Yugoslavia was building up. So, hey, Rwanda, who's interested? So from a situation during the Cold War, of maybe three or four missions going on at any time, and all of them Chapter 6, non-threatening, we end up by 1993 with 15 UN missions, and all of them are Chapter 7, which means the use of force. The last time they had used a Chapter 7 in the Cold War was Korea. So you can imagine the learning curve, particularly within the UN structure, but also the nations that are trying to fill the void abandoned by developed countries. And abandoned is not a facile statement because when in Rwanda during the genocide, I was able to convince a number of Franco and Anglo-African nations to provide me with the battalions I needed, I couldn't get them there because the developed countries didn't want to give me the strategic lift to move them. And then when we worked out a deal that the developed countries would sort of sponsor a battalion. As an example, the Americans were going to sponsor the Ghanaian battalion. So they needed armored personnel vehicles, they needed radios, machine guns. Out of the thousands of armored vehicles sitting in Germany, doing nothing but rusting, they went into a lengthy negotiation of rental. So the United States rented 50 armored personnel vehicles for $14 million. And it took over a month to negotiate it, let alone get the stuff there, get it painted white, put the radios in it that we were scrounging from somewhere else. It was perverse, absolutely perverse. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, the French are fiddling with the extremists because the French believe that Rwanda is going to turn into an Anglo country because the rebels were Anglophiles. And they thought that the Americans were really trying to muscle into their realm of the Franco-Africa. And so they were supporting
the
one
Hutu
side.
Government.
Yeah. And so you get also a nation, a world power, supporting the extremists to the extent of supporting them that they then convinced the UN, which has nothing left. I mean, it's got nothing in the bins. It's got no money.
And what month is this roughly now?
We're now in about the end of May, June. So we're 2 months into the genocide. We've got about 500,000 bodies floating all over the place. And we're close to about 3 million people.
And the French are still supporting the Hutu, knowing that there are 500,000 bodies.
To the extent that they convinced the Security Council that it's unacceptable to continue to see this slaughter going on. Because they all hoped that the thing would end in a couple of weeks, but it didn't. It kept on going because there was nothing to stop them. The French said, we've got to stop this. They said, we want a Chapter 7 mission, and we're going to go in with a combined force of Franco-African countries, and we will establish a humanitarian protection zone. So what they do is they bring in about 2,000 French soldiers. Most of them were already in Africa and other areas. And they bring in a platoon from Senegal and a platoon from Mali and a couple others to just sort of give them a color of being a multilateral force. And they come in with Jaguar jets, armored vehicles, heavy guns and so on. And they're not coming in there to establish a humanitarian protection zone. They're coming in for a big fight. And so I end up as a Chapter 6 mission that was a peacekeeping mission, establishing the demilitarized zone between the rebel forces that are advancing and winning and the French forces that are trying to establish a humanitarian protection zone, which really is a zone where the extremists were hiding and rearming. So I'm a UN mission being the patroller and the negotiator between the other UN mission and the rebel force.
You just made me think when you're talking about the rebel forces and Paul Kagame, who I think is still president, He's kind of become a Western media darling in a way. Mm. But there's been some talk in certain academic circles that he was leading an equally brutal force and then also shot down the plane of the president, allegedly. Do you think that Paul Kagame is as culpable as, say, the other side?
No, and no, in all the questions. There is no doubt that Paul Kagame is ruthless. He grew up in a refugee camp. Their family was thrown out of Rwanda by the Hutu extremists, fought with Museveni to get rid of Idi Amin and Obote, studied here in the United States at Leavenworth, a very effective commander. His officers and NCOs were very effective in the Ugandan army. So they were then under pressure from the Ugandans to get out of Uganda. These refugee camps were creating problems for them. And so they wanted to go back to Rwanda or at least get a Rwandan passport so they can go somewhere else. Rwandans refused and that took off the war. So he's got a big chip on his shoulder on how his family and him, they have been treated and how they find themselves after fighting for the Ugandans being thrown out but not having a place to go. So they take matters in their own hands. So you do have a rebel force, however, that is incredibly disciplined and well-trained and well-motivated and focused and well-led with a political structure that has a very high educated strata to it that has looked at what they want to do should they win the war. On the other side, you've got a government force and a government structure that is torn between extremists and moderates, that is a force that is not well-trained, not well-motivated, that is really nearly decrepit, except for some elite units, and has within it a visceral hatred for the Tutsis that is nurtured by the political elite wing, which is extremist, that is influencing the whole of the structure of not only military, but the gendarmerie and also the public service. So you've got this gang that essentially has said that the only way we're going to be able to keep power, because we've got a dictator here, is by eliminating the opposition. And the peace agreement that was signed in 93 essentially eroded so much of the power of the dictator that they felt that they were in fact vulnerable to being thrown in jail, these extremists. The power struggle was, how do we get rid of the Tutsis in order to sustain power, and can we do it? And their assessment of what the reaction of the international community was is we probably would be able to pull it off. They had seen what had happened in coup d'etat in Burundi in October, and there had been next to no response. And I ended up with 300,000 Burundi refugees and over 40,000 bodies floating in the river. So there was next to no reaction in the international community. They thought that they would be able to pull it off, and so they did it. So there was, on one side, a very structured force with a deliberate aim that they were coming back home and they wanted their share of power. On the other side, you had a gang that had taken power but had sort of languished ineptitude under a dictator, and their structures were riddled by extremist thinking, but also caught up in a quandary because there were moderates also there, particularly in the South, that didn't necessarily agree with what was going on. So the extremists take control and they create a scenario in which they can launch their genocide, and they actually implement it. So a genocide happened. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. No revisionism by academics and all kinds of NGOs that have looked at it. Alison DeForge, even in her work previous to that, recognized that there was a genocide that happened. No problem there. Question is, with that genocide, there was a civil war. So the rebel forces are attacking the government forces. In the nature of civil wars, the general population is not on the sides and watch these soldiers fight. The general population is an instrument of war. And what you do is you create a mass of population in order to be your negotiating base when peace comes or peace agreements or when you have to negotiate. So the extremists decide to move the general population and exterminate the Tutsis as they're doing it. So they move millions of people. And they create fear that permits that movement by the extremist radio station that describes the rebels as demons, that they have long teeth, they even have a tail, they have horns, they eat Hutu babies, and on and on and on and on. And this is a highly illiterate population, and so whatever comes off the radio is nearly the voice of God. Add rape to that, and you have then a nation that is now mobile. With that scenario going on, they are moving massive numbers of people and they're slaughtering. The rebel forces are coming down, and what do they find? Slaughtered family. A lot of these people still had family in Rwanda. Although close to a million Tutsis escaped in 1959-60, close to a million still stayed in Rwanda. So you had at the time about 1.2 million Tutsis in the country, plus those who were mixed marriages. The bulk of them were slaughtered, and they had family in the peripheral areas, and these forces were the sons and daughters of the people who had been thrown out. And so when they're coming down through the villages and they're finding their family slaughtered, what do you think happens? So exactions go on, and they are interestingly structured in as much as Kagame court-martialed and shot soldiers who raped. He also prevented looting from happening, but he also had a strong paranoia on security. And because his force was smaller, much smaller than the other side, and of large territory with vast populations, he wanted to ensure that he had security behind him. And so he conducted a sort of a follow-on in regards to ensuring that there were no extremists left behind as they continued to advance to the country. And so there were exactions done. The scale of that is still up for grabs. How much of that was done? How many of the Hutu officers and families that were slaughtered? How many of the refugees who were Hutu came back and were culled for those who had committed slaughter? And remember, here we have no more government, we've got no more structure, and essentially to blame a person for having conducted a rape or killing of a neighbor, all you needed was 5 witnesses. And so there were, exactions. And the scale is to be questioned. But there's nowhere near the similitude or the link between an actual genocide that would have wiped out the 1.2 million Tutsis.
And almost did.
Yeah, would have done that and as its aim and then keep control of the country. And the other guy who's coming in and trying to keep control, both of his own troops, but also of establishing a secure environment, which in the scenarios of civil wars can be horrifically ruthless.
When we look at what you witnessed and what you've been thinking about, because it's clear you've been really thinking this through for some time now, and it's been, 16 years?
17 years.
17 years. Is this a situation that is unique, or is this something that we have a lot of lessons for the rest of the world that we can draw from?
It was deemed to be a vulnerability that exists in the international community in a time frame in a new era, the sort of postmodern era after the Cold War, where we have nations that were created artificially with absolutely no logic whatsoever. It was based purely on land grabs by the colonial powers and split communities, split ethnicities, tribals, and so on. People don't want to fiddle with the borders, and so they want sovereign states. But in so doing, they're also keeping a whole whack of problems in there. So we end up in a completely new era where it's not nation state going after nation state, but it is imploding nation, failing states, where we have civil wars. And there is nothing more ruthless than a civil war.
And because of the colonial powers that had gone in there, these ethnic groups really were demarcated by the colonial powers and divided. You saw this in so many countries. It wasn't just Rwanda. We saw this in Sri Lanka, for example, and we saw this in Burundi.
It was not done by all. Not all the colonial powers acted the same way, nor did they leave the same legacy. The British colonies essentially had a pretty stable bureaucracy established and system of governance there that could function without the sort of the governor general and the heavy hand. And so there was a methodology and an educated sort of elite that could handle it. Other countries, I mean, you take Portugal, you take Italy, they left nothing and ripped everything out of it and ensured that they killed as much as they could before they left. So you've got a scale of state of nations, brand new nations, and what they've got to work with. And in the context that we find ourselves is many of these nation states that had been sort of held under authoritarian regimes from the early 60s right through to the end of the Cold War, all this sort of frustration simply stayed there and festered until we said we didn't need them anymore. And so we also said, we want you to democratize and we want elections and so on. Well, how do you take a country that's been 150 years under colonial rule, then is under 25 years of a dictator, and then all of a sudden you're going to turn it in a couple of years into a democracy with a multi-party system, and its makeup has absolutely no logic because you've got one ethnicity that's 85% of the population, the other one is 14, and then there's another minority, so the 12. But so how do you create democracy and within the incredible milestones that we impose? I mean, I was given 2 years to move them to a democratic election. That was the last thing they needed. They needed to build up the institutions. They needed to have an interim government and then build slowly up the institutions of governance and the media, the whole process of bringing about a judicial system and integrating the forces and all that and have that stabilized. And then, as they're doing that, let the parties sort of present themselves, let the parties get elected with their own people, and then have an election.
We'll continue our conversations with General Romeo Dallaire next week. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, our scholar circle help us to make sense of the tumult in the Middle East. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. 2011 brought us three revolutions, Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya, and a series of additional attempts for revolution in the Middle East. But the other attempted revolutions have ostensibly either failed or spiraled into violence with human rights abuses. How much has changed in the Middle East over the past year, and has there been a net positive impact from the uprisings? Professor Lori Brand joins us. She is professor of international relations at University of Southern California, and the author of numerous books, including Citizens Abroad, Immigration in the State in the Middle East and North Africa, Women and the State in Political Liberalization, Middle Eastern and North African Experiences. Professor Hamoud Salhi also joins us. He is Director of Negotiation, Conflict Resolution, and Peacebuilding, Chair of Public Policy and Professor of Political Science at Cal State University, Dominguez Hills. Professor Salhi is a contributor to numerous media programs, including Algeria's national television, the BBC, and Al Jazeera, and he hosts KPFK's Radio Intifada. He's working on two books now, including one on Obama and the Arab Spring. Nader Hashemi is with us. He is professor of international studies at the University of Denver. He has authored many articles and publications, including Islam, Secularism, and the Liberal Democracy, Toward a Democratic Theory for the Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, the Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. So welcome to all of you. Lori Brand, I want to begin with you. How do you characterize the post uprising Middle East? How much has changed, and given where we are today, has there been a net positive impact?
Huge questions, but all very important ones. Well, I guess the first thing that I would say is that for some countries, I suppose we can call this post-uprising, but for others, I mean, Syria is clearly still in the thick of things. Yemen remains a bit of an enigma to me, but the contestation over the future role of Saleh, or his relatives at least, and what that government is going to look like continues. I mean, clearly we have Tunisia and Egypt where I think you can say the first chapter in this is clearly over, but the current chapters are just as interesting with as many possibilities as there are challenges, I think. And then we have a couple of others, sort of Morocco and Jordan, where there have been the respective monarchies have tried to make some kind of incremental changes as a way of trying to, you know, buy off opposition, and they've succeeded to varying degrees. So, I mean, I think that this is still a region very much in flux. I think that, you know, 2012 is likely to bring as momentous changes. Maybe they'll seem a little bit less so because they won't have been the first ones, but I think we're going to continue to see dramatic things unfolding. And just to quickly answer the third question, and then I assume you'll want to ask for some specifics either from you or from others, but is this a net positive? I think yes. I mean, clearly there's been loss of life along the way. There have been gross human rights violations in a variety of places. But the fact that in a number of Arab states we've seen the forced departure of autocrats who had been in power for decades, the opening up of possibilities for greater participatory governments, for more governments that are more respectful of human rights, that are going to hopefully also try and put in place economic programs that are going to be more responsive to the needs of people and the challenges of this millennium. I think those are all positive things, and certainly there has been suffering along the way, and there will continue to be. There's no doubt, but the depth of the roots of these autocratic regimes was such that it was hard to imagine any kind of serious broad-based change without some serious dislocation.
You just returned from Jordan and had made some observations that you thought were important. Can you share some of that with us?
Yeah, obviously people will know that what's going on in Jordan is not nearly as momentous as what we see in other places, but as one of the monarchies that's trying to find its way to forestall a spinning out of control of events through kind of incremental gestures, I'm not quite sure I would call them reforms, it's an interesting place to watch. One of the things that I guess I was most surprised by when we were there was the degree to which people are extremely uncertain about the future, and there's a great deal of anxiety, not much confidence in the king at all. I know he's loved outside of Jordan, he and his wife, but dwindling confidence in him and his abilities to lead the country, real uncertainty about how much control he actually has, many people thinking that it actually is the intelligence services that are running most of the important aspects of the country. And so it was a sort of sobering reminder of the kind of power jockeying that is going on sort of just beneath the surface, the lack of I mean, people from outside often look at Jordan as kind of bulwark of security and stability and so on. But beneath the surface, a lot of anxiety and a lot of uncertainty about the future there as well.
Hamoud Salhi.
Yeah. Oh, certainly, some of the things that Dr. Brown was talking about, the uncertainty that is sweeping the entire region. When you look at places where you did not have or you have some kind of revolutionary change, for example, in Algeria, where you have demonstrations, people are still questioning whether this will lead to major revolutionary change. I think the leaders got it. The opposition or the people on the streets also get it. The absence, we no longer have that kind of fear. And we've seen this with the Egyptian. We've seen that with the Tunisian. But what is also important to underline is that as these demonstrations takes momentum, we also got the regimes who are also inventing new tools to deal with them. For example, now the Facebook, the YouTube, all these technological tools have been used by the activists or the demonstrators. Now it's the government that is using for their own interests to promote an image of themselves or to counter the revolutionaries. When we look at also the Egyptian case, where we've seen, for example, as soon as the demonstrations went home, you have a counter-revolutionary that came in with the military wanting to take decisions that would sort of promote the same elite. The third thing is that we've seen elections, and we're learning more and more that the Islamists, with some kind of funding from the outside, could be the biggest benefactors. Also related to that, when we look at the Tunisian case, for example, where suddenly the Nahda party became one of the most dominant organizations. Now, I'm not disputing the fact that the Nahda is a successful organization, but the way they were able to take over the political scenes, the advertisement, the campaign, there were several reports that suggested that a lot of money came from Qatar, from other places. So it's really a lot of political gaming, and I think both the activists, the demonstrators, the peoples, and the governments are getting it. Now, there is a third variable here, another variable, is the money that the Gulf countries are spending on buying out the support. I don't know how long will that last. Perhaps when you take the other factor, the money that is being spent on military weaponry, the increased tensions in the Gulf region, the latest call by the GCC to form a union by the Saudi King Abdullah is also another indication that the governments and the monarchies are sort of trying to spin it in ways that would benefit them. But it's a long time from it's over, and we'll see. But 2012 could be the year where we'll see more of this revolutionary change.
I agree with a lot of what Professor Salhi said. The one sort of outlying country that I see, even if we're talking about sort of learning from what's going on, would appear to be the Syrian regime. The speeches that Bashar al-Assad has given most recently, just 2 days ago, seems to be completely tone-deaf, completely without creativity, without any, aside from trying to appeal to earlier narratives about colonialism and Zionism and so on. And it may be a reflection that the regime simply doesn't know how to deal with this, but they don't seem to have come up with any more ingenious or clever solutions or mm-hmm. strategies to try and put down the revolt in Syria.
I'm definitely going to want to talk about Syria more in depth, but let's first bring in Nader Hashemi.
I think there is a net positive impact, and I think we will only be able to see it 5, maybe 10 years down the road. I think one of the problems in the analysis of the Arab uprisings is there was a sense that this might be another replay of what we saw in Eastern Europe post-1989 and the assumption that you would have demonstrations protest the fall of old regimes and then a smooth and quick transition to a liberal democracy. The Middle East is not Eastern Europe. There's a completely different historical and political context there. And so the assumptions that I think many people had that there would be quick victories, smooth transitions to liberal democracy, I think if you approached the Arab Spring from that perspective, then you're going to be disappointed. But generally speaking, I think that, the net positive gain is that I see is that now for the first time in a very long time, the focus of international attention is on the question of democracy, and it is exposing the machinations and the policies of authoritarian and dictatorial regimes. No longer is the analysis about a pro-Western sort of axis versus an Iran-Syria Hezbollah axis as the main sort of dividing line that helps us understand the politics of the region, although that certainly is still there, or no longer is it simply sort of a sectarian divide, although that is, still part of the politics. Now, for the first time, I think it's very healthy that democratic movements, democratic groups, democratic opposition leaders are gaining a voice, and dictatorial regimes now are being exposed and scrutinized in ways that they haven't been for a very long time. And so I think the focus now being on the question of democracy is very healthy. I think that's what the primary divide in the region has been for a very long time between ruling elites and populations down below. And so that's the focus of the politics of the region. And we've seen different levels of success and setback. I think Tunisia is way far ahead of the rest of the region in terms of a progress toward democracy. Other countries haven't experienced any major sort of disruption yet. I mean, Syria, as was mentioned, is really a basket case given the level of killing and the extent of the human rights violations taking place there. But generally, the region has shifted. I think, you know, this is going to be a long-term process. Even if democracy is crushed tomorrow, the democratic protests are crushed, let's say, in Syria tomorrow, a legacy is going to be left behind that future democratic leaders and activists will be able to draw upon. There's no really getting away from the fact that the old sort of era of dictatorships, of these social contracts that were sort of developed between ruling elites who sort of said that we would provide the basic necessities of life for their populations and the populations would just sort of acquiesce to dictatorial or elite rule. That era is passing away, and I think we're heading into a much more healthier direction. But the point here needs to be emphasized. We still have a very long way to go before, you know, anyone can claim victory here in terms of a democratic transition in these countries.
Let's get into Syrian politics. Laurie Brand, they're ostensibly on the outs with most of the other Arab countries aligned with Iran, hostility going on with Turkey, and human rights abuses. How do we understand the politics of Syria?
Unlike, I think, the early days of the unfolding of the Tunisian revolt and revolution in Egypt, where I felt like I could rely on Al Jazeera for very helpful coverage, that has gradually diminished. I think it first began with the problem with Bahrain, and then since then, I mean, it's been much more difficult to find balanced reporting coming out of Al Jazeera. The question then is, where does one go if one wants to try and figure out what's going on? And a lot of the Arab media is funded by the Saudis or Al Jazeera, Qatar, and they have their own point of view that they want to get across. So it really is a challenge to try and get a sense for what's going on being outside. And I think the people inside, of course, the way that the revolt, the uprising in Syria has evolved is such that there have been sort of changing centers of it, and so that you would have an outbreak in one place for several days or several weeks, and then it would move somewhere else, or there would be multiple centers. Homs has become, over the last several months, certainly one of the bloodiest places, and some of the villages outside of Homs, places of sectarian killings or massacres, depending on the scale. But I think one of the real challenges for people who are analysts is where do we get in the good information? Who do we rely on? How do we try and balance or see beyond or between the lines of propaganda. But this appears to be a long way from over in Syria. There still is significant regime support, and I think that that is sometimes underemphasized in Western reporting because there's obviously a great deal of opposition to the kind of abuses of the regime, not just recently, but over the years. And yet it seems very clear that in the two largest cities, in Aleppo and Damascus, there continues to be significant support for the regime. We have not seen massive defections from the military. There have not been massive defections. There haven't been defections from the upper ranks of the political wings of the regime, from any sort of Syrian diplomats. So this, it looks like Libya in some ways, what began in Libya with very early on with defections, although I think there was a lot of back and forth, we haven't seen in Syria. So the regime still does have an important base of support. It's difficult to know how extensive and how deep that is at this point.
Hamoud Saleh?
I think I agree with Dr. Brand. There is a difficulty getting a reliable information from Syria. But also there is a point there that Dr. Brand was referring to, this idea that the regime continues to have support. But it's also undermined and has been challenged from different perspectives. And what we've seen so far is the failure of Assad, Bashar al-Assad, to connect with the Syrian people. Remember about a year ago or so, when this thing started, we thought, a lot of analysts thought, that actually Assad got it, that Syria would not be going through this kind of challenges. After all, Bashar is known, or at least until this episode, was known as someone who could actually, people give him the benefit of the doubt. This guy who was, you know, brought from London to be in charge, the constitution was amended just for his pleasure. The constitution doesn't allow a person to be a leader of Syria under the age of 40. He didn't have 40. His military rank overnight, became a lieutenant general or something. In a matter of 6 months, he moved from nobody in the military to the rank of that. And a lot of people gave him the benefit of the doubt. And more than that, he was seen as a leader that would modernize and bring Syria in line with information technology. He was the head of the technological society that his father appointed him to. And he was also, at the end, seen as one of those young leaders with Hamad in Bahrain, with Abdullah in Jordan, or Mohammed VI in Morocco. These are the new breed that one had sort of hope that they would actually bring the Middle East to the next stage. But suddenly, what we've seen in the last year or so is a total detachment from the population. His second speak that he gave, for example, he appeared as if he was really addressing a bunch of CEOs. He was very sort of businesslike, no emotion whatsoever. Until recently, this was last week, 2 days ago, was his fourth speech. Bashar did not meet with his people, did not address the Syrian people. I'm told he went down to Damascus and talked to a few people, of course, his supporters. But it's been, as it has been, a major disappointment. The other pattern we've seen is that there is a sense that it's not Bashar who is doing this. But again, we've seen that with his father, where it was not Assad who was doing this, but his brother, the bad guy. In this case, it's Maher, Bashar's brother, who is doing the kill and all of that. And it's a sense, or it's a way of protecting him by the elite. But Syria is a very, very challenging, as Dr. Brandt said. The condition is very challenging. If we look at the opposition today, again, the opposition is divided, it's fragmented, and even the regional politics is also...
It even seems the Arab League has given up, it seems.
Well, the Arab League is a joke more than anything else. I think it's the irony of all of this is that the most dysfunctional, unuseful organization was asked to go and monitor these things. And from a bigger perspective, the Arab League was not there to solve the problem or to contribute to its solution. It was there to actually bring some kind of information or documentation that would give a green light for my analysis, a green light for the Security Council or the United Nations to intervene in Syria. We've seen that with Libya, and I think we're going through the same process that would lead to that. Basically, give documentation that the situation warrant an international intervention. And so far, the opposition is divided. The Syrian National Congress is for it, basically because the leadership of that organization is based outside, but the position inside Syria is against it. So we're really seeing a country that has continued to be in crisis. And what is very, very interesting in all of this, it seems like it's in the best interest of the United States, and according to Israeli reports, that Syria has continued to be destabilized. And as long as it is destable to a point where Bashar is not overthrown, the parties all around in the region and the superpowers, in this case, United States, are okay with that. And I think that's the tragedy of the whole thing.
Nader Hashemi.
Yeah, I have a much more critical take on what's taking place in Syria than the previous two guests. I'm of the view that we actually do know what's going on. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch,
sure.
The United Nations Human Rights Council issued several very honest, very incisive, very accurate reports. These are very serious organizations, and they tell us actually what is taking place, and it's a humanitarian nightmare. All three organizations use the term crimes against humanity. Let's not forget that Bashar Assad's reaction to the pro-democracy protests, it comes as no surprise to me. When you compare the Arab regimes and their human rights record, Bashar Assad's regime, the Ba'athist regime in Syria, lies at the extreme end of the human rights spectrum in terms of its human rights record. I mean, only Saddam Hussein's regime, I think, was arguably worse than the situation in Syria. So the reaction that the regime has sort of demonstrated, the extreme violence, the crimes against humanity, I think was completely predictable. This is not a regime that's able to reform itself. I think the analysis that sort of elevated the role of Bashar Assad as this young individual who perhaps was a reformist and can bring about the change ignores the fact that, you know, the politics of these regimes is not really about one individual. This is a broad sort of apparatus of individuals, a military regime that deeply entrenched in society, and it's not about one individual coming in and bringing about reforms. With respect to the support that the regime has, yes, I think it's accurate to say that the regime does have some support, but the fact that we haven't seen demonstrations in the major cities, Aleppo and Damascus, does not, I think, in my view, translate into support for Bashar Assad. I think it can perfectly be explained by the fact that the population are terrorized and are living in fear. This is a brutal dictatorship. To come out on the street means that you effectively lose your life. I don't necessarily interpret the absence of demonstrations in the major cities as a sign of support for Bashar Assad. I think it can be interpreted in a completely different perspective. And I think if Bashar Assad actually had support, then there would have been some attempt in the past to have some meaningful sort of representative elections where he could sort of bank on that and draw upon that to justify the existing political status quo. I think the claims that Bashar Assad has significant support, in my view, are exaggerated. We don't know, and there's no way actually we can ever know unless there was free and fair elections or some sort of referendum. It's true that the regime is manipulating sectarian sentiment. It's completely understandable that the minority groups are terrified. But I think if, hypothetically, the opposition could have free rein to come out into the streets and demonstrate sort of how much support it actually has, the numbers, I think, would increase significantly. So I think the situation in Syria, I think, is very desperate, and I really don't see how we can get out of the current malaise that is engulfing that country absent some sort of military defection or internal coup. And all of these uprisings that we've seen, the way that these things typically sort of end or at least move into a new direction is when some segment of the military, as we saw in Tunisia, as we saw in Egypt, as we saw in Libya in a certain sense, there's some sort of internal military coup or the military refuses to shoot on, to fire on the people anymore. We've seen if that'll happen in Syria.
I really would like to also talk about what is going on with the hostilities that seem to be escalating between Iran and Israel and the United States, and what that really means. And Nader Hashemi, we've been having you start last. Why don't you start first on this?
Yeah, we're headed, I think, for a very dangerous sort of crisis situation. Basically, I think the problem is rooted in the attempt by the United States and its allies to dictate to the world which countries can have nuclear weapons and which countries cannot. After the release of the IAEA report in November, there's been a concerted effort to sort of tighten the sanctions on Iran, to effectively collapse its economy. And the Iranians, you know, are not going to sit back and watch their entire economy collapse. So they've threatened that they're going to close down the Straits of Hormuz. They are, you know, very upset that their nuclear scientists now are being assassinated. Unfortunately, I think the way things are headed, we're seeing both extremists, both in the United States, I think in the Republican Party and in the pro-Israel lobby, who are really pushing this agenda for an attack on Iran. They and their counterparts in the Islamic Republic of Iran are, you know, mutually reinforcing each other and unleashing forces that I'm afraid are leading us into a crisis situation and a possible war. I really don't see any way around it unless some sort of cooler heads can prevail, and I don't see any cooler heads prevailing in the near future.
Laurie Brand.
I just add a few things to that. I agree with most of what you said. I think it is of great concern that the kinds of things that we've been hearing, the sorts of claims, often exaggerated, in some cases baseless claims, about Iran's nuclear capabilities, their intentions, and so on. All of these things, I think, have parallels if one looks back to the 2002 to early 2003 period when preparation was being made. The decision, in fact, had already been taken. We know that now, to go to war against Iraq. So I think that it's very important that those of us who are concerned, you know, continue to speak out and try and at least make people aware of these kinds of parallels, because I think particularly in an election year where it's so easy for rhetoric that appears not to have serious U.S. domestic implications, for people to just see it in the various Republican debates, the kinds of wild claims being made about Iran, about intentions about Iran, these have very, very serious potential ramifications. It's not easy to back down from this, and I think it's a very, very dangerous period. Israel has been expressing concerns about Iran's nuclear intentions for a number of years, as has the United States. But now with the developments in the Arab world closer to home, losing, you know, a protector and ally in the Mubarak regime, concerns about what's happening with other regimes around it, I think it increases probably the sense of insecurity among some of the Israeli leadership, and I think that only then also tends to heighten that rhetoric as well. So I agree with Professor Hashemi. I think this is a very dangerous time.
Hamoud Sahi.
Well, I think we have to put it also on another perspective. Remember when the United States invaded Iraq, it was under the idea that this would be part of the beginning of what you call the preemptive doctrine. Basically, we start with Iraq and then we move either Syria or Iran, and it was which country we should invade next. So there is that perspective, that the idea of Iran being a country that needs to be put in order and to be democratized has existed for a long time. The second very variable that we need to look at is the competition over the leadership of the region, the religious sort of animosities that exist between the Saudis and the Iranian. This has been for decades, and the only period of time that we had the two countries going through a certain kind of relationship, cooperation, is during the reign of President Mohammed Sayed Khatami, which, interestingly enough, during his era, at the time when the current king, Abdullah, and Khatami, they were good buddies, good friends, the relationship with all the countries in the region, were, except with the UAE, were in good standing. In fact, the United Arab Emirates, which accused Iran of colonizing or taking three of its islands, was so upset that the relationship between the Iranian Saudis were done at the expense of Emirati interest. And the UAE were notorious for complaining in the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council Summit meeting. And it was only the UAE that stood against that. And even in the UAE, the relationship between Dubai, the Emirates of Dubai, and Iran were at their best. At that time, and this is where the challenge is, at that time when those relationships were good, the issue in the Gulf was reforms, political reforms. So, and this is a third variable, when the Iranian question has also allowed the monarchies to use the Iranian threat to get away from its main domestic political representation problems. And I think this is another variable that we need to look at when we look at the Iranian. But it's certainly, it's a very, very difficult issue. The Gulf News on Thursday talked about that the assassination of the scientist was something done by the Israelis. And why are the Gulf News positioning that perspective is noteworthy? Because there are groups inside the Gulf countries who are aware that such tension will not benefit the region, and they don't want an attack either from the United States or Israel that would jeopardize their interest, and particularly with the oil flow through the Strait of Hormuz and so on and so forth. So it's very, very delicate, and it continues to take all the headlines, particularly on the election day or election year.
I would agree with the previous analysis that, you know, the Saudi-Iran sort of connection is very important here, and that's sort of driving a lot of these tensions that we're seeing in the Middle East, particularly over the situation with Syria, and of course Iraq is the big variable here. There's a sense that, you know, Iraq is now in Iran's camp, and the Saudis are trying to sort of rebalance the regional balance of power by sort of pressuring Syria, Iran's ally, as a way of sort of compensating for what they perceive as a loss of Iraq and Iraq's move into the Iran's camp.
So let me leave it there and say thank you to the three of you, Professor Lori Brand, Professor of International Relations at USC and author of books such as Citizens Abroad, Immigration and the State in the Middle East and in North Africa, Women, the State and Political Liberalization, Middle Eastern and North African Experiences, Professor Hamoud Sahi, Director of Negotiation, Conflict Resolution and Peace Building, Chair of Public Policy and Professor of Political Science at Cal State University, Dominguez Hills, also the host of Radio Intifada here on KPFK, and then Nader Hashemi, Professor of International Studies at the University of Denver, and some of his books include Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Thank you, all three of you, so very much.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks, bye. Thank you, Maria.
That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and extra special thanks to Ankina Ahasyan, who co-produces this show with me, and to Alyssa Dorey, our assistant producer. Most of all, thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.